It's time for a solid hour of business insights and strategies for success on Mind Your Business. And here's your host, the president and founder of Bottom Line Marketing, Yitzhak Saflis.
You're tuned to another edition of Mind Your Business with Yitzhak Saflis right here on 77 WABC, airing in the New York, New Jersey metro area. And I've gotten comments. People have picked us up pretty deep in the western part of Pennsylvania, and people from Boston and then south. I think someone from Baltimore picked us up. So we have 77 WABC is the such a powerful range. And, of course, worldwide at mybradio.com, mybradio.com. Well, I may sound like a broken record here, but I do want to thank the listeners once again. The ratings just came in. We were number 4 in New York AM radio at this hour. I appreciate your trust and confidence in the show, and actually appreciate the various emails and voicemails that I receive from time to time. And when I meet people, it's very special to receive your feedback on a regular basis. Well, as the listeners know, this show on the legendary 77 WABC is all about you. Every single week, we seek out and interview C-level executives and business leaders and ask them the questions that are on your mind. We cover such a wide range of professions and categories, including sales, customer service, emerging technologies, leadership, strategic planning, marketing and advertising, and so much more. Stay tuned for tonight's edition of Mind Your Business, where you'll gain solid advice to get you ahead in today's business world. Well, a couple of thank yous we want to open with. A special thank you to the great team at 77 WABC, James, Matt, Chris, Lexi, Justin, thank you. And to the great team here at Bottom Line Marketing Group, who plays a very important support role for the show, Cirilli, Eliana, Hoodie, Miriam, Dina, thank you. I also want to give a special thank you to the various channels that Mind Your Business is syndicated on. The new column in B-Tank, the last issue featured Rachel Krauss, who is the CMO at Westfield World Trade Center. The upcoming edition is going to feature my guest this evening. So this is a very special feature that we'll be discussing. Also want to mention that we are on C-Suite Radio, C-Suite TV, Audio Boom, Player.fm, iTunes, and we have a robust YouTube channel. A special thank you to Moshe Katz from Las Vegas, who told me that he was able to incorporate a lot of the feedback from our YouTube channel into what he does out there in where he was. So we really appreciate the feedback. Also, want to mention, as I've mentioned many times, but still I'm asked about this all the time, what is the resource where we can pick up all past guests? And it's on mybradio.com, mybradio.com. That is the resource where you could hear the interview I had with John Sculley, the former CEO of Apple and Pepsi, Captain Sully Sullenberger from Miracle on the Hudson, Jason Robinson, Director of Marketing at UPS, and so many other great guests, Steven Sato, of the former CEO of Saks Fifth Avenue. All these guests can be picked up by visiting mybradio.com, mybradio.com. Well, without further ado, we're going to tonight's amazing guest, Bruce Katz. Let me just tell you a little bit about him before we jump into my long list of questions that I want to ask Bruce. Bruce was the founder of the Rockport Shoe Company and has recently founded, not a couple of years ago, the Samuel Hubbard Shoe Company, carrying a tradition of three generations in the of the family being involved in the shoe manufacturing business. He actually pioneered the first large-scale online community, The Well. If there's time, we'll talk about that, and founded Well Engaged. Bruce was also the chairman and principal shareholder of Delphi.com and is currently the co-founder of the Republic of Tea. He has been recognized as an icon of the footwear industry and is the first person to engineer athletic shoe comfort into non-athletic shoes. And regarding Samuel Hubbard, the American Business Awards awarded Samuel Hubbard Shoe Company with the 2018 Gold Stevie Award for customer service. Therefore, we encourage you to stay tuned for tonight's edition, where we will discuss how to grow your business and to be at the top of your industry, the five pillars of customer service excellence, how to market to each type of consumer demographic, and you know, and that obviously that needs to be done with thought and specific strategic direction, and how to stay ahead in the online world. Well, we have a lot to cover with that intro. We give a very warm welcome to Bruce Katz. Bruce, thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Well, this is a loaded question, but we'll figure out a way to do it in under 2 minutes. Tell us about yourself. You're the founder and CEO of the Samuel Hubbard Shoe Company. What could you tell us about your journey?
Well, I got in the shoe business when I was about 23. Okay. And my family's shoe manufacturing business that had gone on for almost 40 years had come to an end because of the imports, because of all the competitive forces, and most of the factories in New England were closing.
Early 70s.
And I came back and found my father starting all over again at the back of a small shoe store and a telex machine and a secretary. And I had never really intended to. I had worked as a child in a shoe factory, but, you know, in the summers, you know, doing different kinds of jobs and learning a little bit about how shoes were made. But it was never my chosen career. I studied engineering physics. And I had a great dream that I wanted to sail around the world. And I had spent several years working to build a boat. And I came back and sort of innocently started. My father said, I have some shoes that you could sell that are sitting in this warehouse that somebody canceled. And he said, maybe you could sell them and make some money for your boat. So I started driving around with my Volkswagen truck and my dog, with no idea what I was doing, just calling on people and mostly leather shops, small independent shoe stores. And people liked the shoes, and I sold them all. And then, as fate would have it, I made enough money to start going to look to maybe buy a boat that I could just get started on my journey. And I had a car accident in Jamaica, a very unfortunate accident, which kind of set me back. And that gave me time to think, and I decided, well, maybe I need more security. I should come back and maybe sell, you know, find a way to make a little more money before I just get stuck on a boat with no money to go, you know, go anywhere. I came back, and as I went back out and tried to sell a few more shoes for my dad, I found out that the shoes we had sold, people loved. But we had never put a name on them. So one day I'm walking down the street, I find a guy, and I said, wow, what are those shoes you're wearing? And he said, oh, these are my favorite shoes. I've never had a shoe this comfortable. I said, where'd you get them? And he said, you know, I can't remember where I bought them, but I really wish I could because my roommate wants to buy a pair. And I went to a phone booth. About 10 minutes later, I called my father. I said, you know what? We have to put a name on these shoes so that people will know what they are. And so that's how Rockport started. And I spent 14 years doing that. And about 5 weeks before we were to be public, the red herring was published. Everything was ready to go. We had 100 shares in the company because there had never been any investment other than the little bit that we put in. The whole company, Rockport, was created on $15,000 of paid-in capital ever. So when at that point we were going to go public, you know, at a big, big number. And I had 100. There were 100 shares, the same 100 shares that we started with. And I just decided that I made a personal decision that I just didn't know if I wanted to spend the rest of my life doing this and the pressures that were already mounting from all these guys from Wall Street. I said, you know, there's an expression, the man who knows when enough is enough always has enough. It's a Sufi expression. And I just said, you know, my friend said, what do you need this for? And so I left and went out to California, where I had always wanted to live, in San Francisco, and I fell into an entirely different business. I got involved in the online community business in the infancy, before the web, several years before that even started. And I took over The Well from Stuart Brand, which was the online community.
So this is late 80s, early 90s?
This was probably by 1989 or 90. Right. I was email was something that we used to send messages across the office.
Right, CompuServe.
There was none of that. Well, you couldn't even send a message to anybody outside the building because there was no way to connect to anybody.
Right, it was only internal networks.
We had internal mail. And so it all started, and I was there when all that began. And So I spent another 14. It seems like my life is in 14-year chapters. I spent 14 years building on online communities, pioneering it, building Well Engage, which was the first web-based discussion software. We had the place where you could get your own web page and have your own discussions and links, and, you know, like at least 15 years before Facebook ever started, I think.
Wow.
And that but then eventually I came back, you know, then then time goes by. I had a daughter, and one day, you know, I didn't have a child till I was 58. And one day when my daughter was 8 years old, she came to the dining table and said, the picture of a shoe. She said, Dad, we should do shoes together. And I said, do you know that I used to be in the shoe business? I didn't even know that she ever knew that. I didn't talk about it particularly.
Right.
And she said, yeah. She said, Grandpa told me that you used to make shoes.
Wow.
And so I said, I'll think about this. Let me think about this for a while. And that's how Samuel Hubbard began.
Amazing.
And here I am back in the shoe business.
Wow. We have a lot to cover, so I'm going to jump right in. Everyone knows the saying, you know, beauty is pain, or, you know, no pain, no gain. There's people might feel that, you know, to wear a nice and attractive pair of shoes, you know, you're going to have to suffer. Samuel Hubbard is the exact opposite. He could wear a very fashionable pair, and it's extremely comfortable. You know, how did you even solve that, to begin to wrap your head around and say, you know what, it doesn't have to be painful to wear an attractive pair of shoes?
No, well, when I was at Rockport in the shoe business, I was almost the anti-fashion guy. I was the guy who would go around and say to people, you know, in the future, people are not going to wear, you know, ties and jackets and dress that way. They're going to wear, you know, much more it's not going to just be casual Friday. They all thought it was sort of heretic to say this and stuff. And I thought, you know, people want to be comfortable eventually. It's not just on Friday they want to be comfortable. And the whole lightweight shoe concept started when Nike brought out the waffle trainer, the first. I still have a pair, the original pair, wow, because I bought a pair and I put these things on and they were so light and so comfortable. I went, oh my God. And we had been making these crepe sole heavy shoes that probably weighed 4 or 5 pounds a pair. They were very comfortable, bouncy shoes, but they were like lead. I put these on and I said, this is it. I said, if we don't make shoes like this, we're finished. Wow. I mean, the day will come when people only will want to wear this. So I really set myself a goal. I said, if the shoe is not as comfortable as a running shoe, this is not going to be a shoe I'm going to wear, and I don't think anyone else eventually is going to wear either. And we started off making kind of casual type shoes in those days, and eventually we realized, well, people still want to look sharp.
Right.
And so how do you do that? So that took, I learned that years and years ago, that what it took to do that. But when I came back to it this time, I decided that I could improve on that and improve on
Amazing.
It a lot. And so I just took the limits off and I said, what could we do to make the best possible shoe that people, they just put it on and you go, yes.
Yeah.
And so we just set no limits for ourselves. We used the finest leathers and we leather lined the shoe, and I bought maybe 100 orthotics and I tried them all out, and, you know, I would be the guy at the component show in Germany going around barefoot, running up and down the aisle, trying on different things. People would go and squeeze them. I'd say, no, let me put that in my shoe. And so little by little, I found out a way to do it. And I mean, there's a limit. You cannot make super pointed shoes because the foot isn't shaped that way. But if you make the shoe a little longer, you can give it a nice look. And so that's
what we've done. But it's still a bit, I mean, aside from the fact that you know, many in the audience have seen the ads in the Wall Street Journal, et cetera, you're clearly also targeting the business community, the businessman who needs to be sharp, but at the same time doesn't want to be in pain all day.
When I look at right now it's amazing coming back to the business and seeing how many people are wearing sneakers for everything. I mean, I just went to Paris a few weeks ago just to shop the windows and see mm-hmm. what, and to Milan.
Mm-hmm.
And over there, I mean, all the women are wearing nothing but sneakers. All the fancy shoes, you can't find them. They're all, you can buy $800 sneakers, but they're,
wow,
you know, we're pretty crazy looking stuff. I think it was possible to have, you know, something that looked appropriate for a business setting, but that had the same comfort. And I knew I could do that. And so really we came up with this idea of what we started calling the unsneaker.
Which is going to be my next question.
And how to do that, because I don't think everybody has to look like they're just, you know, like they just came from the gym, you know, with a baseball right. hat and right. a pair of gym right. shoes right. and they're right. going no, to a board to, meeting.
Correct. No, it's not appropriate and it's not the right setting. And many times it could even affect the conversation. Packaging is a very, very critical role in any setting and certainly in a business setting. My guest this evening is none other than Bruce Katz, founder and CEO of the Samuel Hubbard Shoe Company. We're going to take a short commercial break. Stay tuned.
Hey, Joe, give me a minute. I'm going to run the numbers and circle back next week. Post it on Facebook, LinkedIn. Just get it up there.
You're great at what you do, and you're busier than ever. We get that. Imagine if you could devote every minute of your day to running your business and taking it to the next level. Enter Bottom Line Marketing Group. Bottom Line Marketing Group focuses on making your company look great, so you can focus on growing your business. To see some award-winning projects produced by Bottom Line Marketing Group, visit www.bottomlinemg.com. That's www.bottomlinemg.com. Or call CEO Yitzhak Saflis on his direct line for a free consultation at 718-412-3505. That's 718-412-3505. Bottom Line Marketing Group. Marketing solutions to grow your bottom line.
Finally, a payroll service that does things your way. At Brands Paycheck, you're not a number, you're a partner. Brands Paycheck's personalized payroll solutions ensure that your business receives your financial information the way you want it. From complete payroll services and time tracking to benefits administration and HR solutions, Brands Paycheck helps streamline your business's payroll process and maximize productivity. Call 888-757-3020. That's 888-757-3020 to schedule a free consultation. Brands Paycheck services a wide range of industries nationwide, including hospitality, transportation, B2B, B2C, nonprofit, finance, retail, healthcare, real estate, and more. Learn why companies nationwide rely on Brands Paycheck. Call 888-757-3020. That's 888-757-3020 to schedule a free consultation today or visit online at BrandsPaycheck.com. That's BrandsPaycheck.com.
And we're back. Mind Your Business with Yitzhak Saflis right here on 77 WABC. My guest this evening is none other than Bruce Katz, the founder and CEO of Samuel Hubbard Shoe Company. There are many in the audience that are very excited about the show because they're probably jumping up and down now in their Hubbards. I know I am in mind, but I'm not jumping up and down. I mean, I'm interviewing the founder and CEO, so I'm behaving myself, but definitely with a very comfortable pair of shoes. So thank you, Bruce. You invented the Unsneaker, okay? It's a trademark of the Samuel Hubbard brand. By the way, you could visit them online. They're retailers nationwide that carry it. But just briefly, many of you are wondering, okay, how can I order a pair? SamuelHubbard.com. Samuel Hubbard is with two Bs, H-U-B-B-A-R-D.com, just to go on and order yourself a pair. But talking about the Unsneaker, how has this one innovative idea grown your business to be one of the, if not the leader in the industry, and explain what the Unsneaker is?
So the notion of the Unsneaker is how do you meet the standard of all these lightweight athletic type shoes that people are used to, you know, and make a conventional shoe? And why would you do that? Well, one of the reasons to do that is, first of all, that a good leather shoe, not only does it look more appropriate in all kinds of settings, whether mm-hmm. it's out to dinner on Saturday night with the right. you know right. family, or whether you're going to a business meeting, right. but also a leather shoe is a much more supportive shoe for walking a lot. And when one of the things that we did over the years at Rockport was we pioneered the whole fitness walking movement, and it became clear when I try to walk a long way in a pair of running shoes, I mean, that they're not exactly designed for walking. They're not as supportive in a way that walking is. And also, if you wear a pair of running shoes and it happens to be, you know, 2 feet of snow in Chicago in the middle of winter, you might like Gore-Tex. You might like to have a non-skid sole that's designed right. to stand on ice. You might like a shearling lining. You right. might like waterproof leather. Right. And so there are many other things that are possible. And the sneakers today are just lighter and they're kind of more minimal. They're all synthetic materials and lightweight. And I'm not taking anything away. They're super comfortable. That's what I measure against. But my gold standard is, if I'm wearing a pair of shoes I don't want to remember I have them on. If at any point in the day I think I have my shoes on, then I've done something wrong. And I've had people write to me and say, you know, I used to come home and take my shoes off when I got to the house, and I realized I was more comfortable wearing the shoes around the house than I was taking them off. Or another guy said, I come down in the morning, I used to put my bed slippers on, now I put on my Hubbards because they're more comfortable than my bed slippers. So, you know, these are the kind of standards that I try to measure up to. And when we design a shoe, unlike many shoe companies, one of the things we do is we take a long time to do it. People in the shoe industry, they have fashion cycles. They have to bring out new shoes every 4 or 5 or 6 months. Some of these shoes, the first shoe took us almost a year and a half to get right. Mm-hmm. And I thought we knew what we were doing. And I had a very, very good shoemaker working with me that I used to work with, a Swiss man, Werner Versch in Portugal. And it took the two of us a year and a half to get one shoe that we said, yes, okay. And
that's
other
such a
shoes,
great point.
Other understand. Shoes have taken 2.5 years. So we just came up with a boat shoe and a golf shoe that it's at least 2.5 years.
Wow.
And the funny thing was when we started the project, it was going to be called Fast Track. And we should have called
developing
it, if we had called it Slow Track, we would have known what we were doing. It was 2.5 years and many moles and many trials of stuff. We said, this isn't good enough. This doesn't work. And going back and back and back. So you can't do that quite in a fashion industry as well as you can do it in this kind of company that we have now, where we really work to get a perfect product each time.
Before in the show, you had talked about Rockport, that which was created a couple of decades ago, and then before it was transferred over to other companies. Perhaps you could share, how has the industry changed over the last few decades? Is that a loaded one?
No, it is. I have to think for a minute because I left the shoe business for 28 years. And when I left it, I really left it. If you imagine that you had spent 14 years getting up at 3 in the morning and making donuts for 14 years, when you finally walk away from the donut business, you don't even want to think about a donut, look at a donut. I had had enough of shoes. I wanted to think about something else, because when you're an entrepreneur, it's 24/7 thinking about what you're doing. And so I took a 28-year break. Coming back to it, I was really it took me a while to realize how different it was. And the first big difference was that the shoe retailers had disappeared. I mean, when I used to have a company that had 5,500 locations where the shoes were sold. Today we have 600 locations, and I will be amazed if we get to 900.
Wow.
To really find shoe stores, because people buy shoes online to a great extent now, and the shoe retailers really, one by one, they disappeared. And I have my own theory about why they disappeared.
Okay.
And in part, I think it's because when the shoe industry went to Asia, the prices were so low compared to what we had been paying. We used to go to Brazil and to Yugoslavia and to, Spain and Portugal.
Right, Europe. Yeah.
And the prices were so relatively low. When I came back to the shoe business, I was surprised how inexpensive shoes were. Mm. And I think part of what happened to the shoe retailers is they started selling cheaper and cheaper products. And while they were doing that, the rent went up, healthcare went up, insurance went up, all their other costs went up.
Wasn't manageable.
And a man didn't walk in and go, oh, gee, the shoes are so inexpensive, I think I'll take three.
Right,
maybe they bought sneakers that way. The other thing, of course, that happened is that everybody moved from shoes into sneakers, so that I don't know what the statistics are, but it's got to be 80 or 90% of all the footwear is some kind of athletic shoe. And these guys, it has different markups. So it was a very, very different landscape. And when I started, I was determined that we were going to build this as a kind of an online business and not a wholesale business. I wasn't intending to go back in the wholesale business, actually.
So, you know, if we could just stay on that point, because this is really a fantastic discussion point, online versus retail. Today's day and age, you gotta ace both. Is that not correct?
I came to the conclusion that if I was going to bring out something, let's call it sort of medium revolutionary, not completely, but people, ever since, we did the whole Rockport thing, all shoe companies put orthotics in. Shoes got a lot more comfortable in the years that I was away from the business, but I felt like if no one had ever tried this shoe on, how was I ever going to convince anybody that this was worth wearing.
Right. And of course, that's the biggest challenge to online shopping.
Yeah. I had modest goals. I mean, I was really thinking of it more like selling grandma's jam out of a garage, you know, on Yahoo stores or something like mm-hmm. this. So it started very like that. I thought, well, my daughter's, you know, going on 10. I've got, you know, another 6-7 years before she goes to college. I got to do something. I could do this. I thought, well, I wanted to go back and make my favorite shoe. Also, I didn't have any more. I was running. I had three,
right. I heard I
had,
you saved 24 pairs.
I took 24 pairs. I was down to three pair. And I thought, what am I going to do when,
this, invent
when,
a company,
these,
so.
When these are gone? I'm going to, I got, what am I going to wear? I was really babying these shoes, and there wasn't even any good way to resole them because the materials weren't available.
That sounds right.
So I decided, okay, I spent 1 year designing the website. I got very into all the aesthetics of the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, I was going to Portugal to make shoes, and it was taking a long time to get the shoe right. Finally, I had a collection of four shoes. So the company, we started with four shoes that I was happy with. And
four designs.
They came in a number of colors. Right. And the manufacturer over there, who I had known from the past, his father had made shoes for my father. He was patient with us, but eventually he was very, very generous and cordial and everything. But one day, probably at a lunch, he said, "You know, are you guys ever going to finally, you know, buy some shoes?" So finally, I said, "Okay, I think we're good now. I'm going to buy these four shoes." So I ended up. When I look back, I think, what on earth was I thinking? I bought 15,000 pair, you know. But probably because I was so used to running a big company, I said, well, we'll start, you know, with 500 of this and 1,000 of that and 1,500 of that. Right, and, right. You know, the black will be bigger, so we'll sell, you know, we'll buy 1,200 of those. That's 15,000 pairs. So they arrive in August. The website is still not done. I have no wholesale business. I have one secretary and one bookkeeper. And one day my secretary said, well, maybe I should try to go sell some of these shoes. I don't know. Maybe we could just at least have a couple stores around here that sell them. Right. So she went out. She had been selling hospice services before that. And, you know, she finally opened one or two stores. So August to January, finally the website is done. The website launches, and we're really excited. Mm-hmm. In May, a conversation at the company would go something like this. Hey, did you hear what happened yesterday? No, what happened? Somebody bought a pair of shoes on the website. Between January and June, I sold 123 pair. Mm. I had 15,000 pair. In a way, I was right back where I started with Rockport. Here, all I needed was a dog and a pickup truck, and I could start driving around trying to peddle these shoes. And I thought, what, you know, how is anybody going to do? Right. So when you open a web shop, unless you can figure out how to talk to people and find people, you might as well open a shoe store on a county road in North Dakota somewhere about 50 miles out of the center of town. I mean, you are nowhere, nowhere at all. And so I finally thought back, well, we used to run, you know, ads. And I thought, well, why don't we try some ads? And so I said, I'm going to, you know, I was trying to keep a modest budget for this whole thing.
Right.
And I said, okay, I'm going to invest another $200,000 in this business because I have all these shoes now. I'm going to put $200,000 worth of ads for the next 6 months and see what happens. And so I went to the New York Times and I bought some seven-inch ads on page three, and I bought some magazine space. The magazine space was, you know, $15,000 a page. I thought, oh, my, well, we'll never really pay for this, but at least we'll announce that we exist. And lo and behold, the first ad ran, I think it was July 23rd, and I had to sell something like, you know, 30 pair to pay for it, and we sold 36 pair. Wow.
Do you remember which magazine that was?
It was in the New York Times, page three.
On the black and white ad
on the bottom right column. And then we ran, you know, the next Tuesday we ran another ad, and we sold another 35 pair, and I went, wow.
So
long story short, within 12 months, I had run over $1 million worth of advertising, and I still had my $200,000. I had, because every single time I ran an ad, I would sell enough shoes to pay for the ad and a little extra left over to, you know, buy a cup of coffee.
Right.
So, and that's how it happened that I went back into print. And, you know, now we're moving to a whole new phase where we've got enough recognition out there that social media becomes much more interesting. And we've done a lot to figure out who our customer is, why do they like our shoes, what is it they're looking for, and all these sorts of things that would lead you to a very different way to go to market. But we did an enormous amount of print. We did, I think, last year, 1.4 billion print impressions.
Wow. Print, right, between Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, and this
Times.
Is very bad. You know, this is very old-fashioned.
Right.
I have friends who say, what are you doing, you know, doing this? And, you know, I really felt to build an awareness. And then the other part of it was that we decided that we really needed to put some shoes out at wholesale because I really wanted people to have the experience of actually trying the shoe on. And until I could build an initial audience like that. Now, I know people have started shoe companies where they're, you know, 100% digital. You know, there are some great examples that right now that are going out that way. I think it works better in women's shoes than trying to get men, you know, into these types of shoes because women love to talk about their shoes. You know, some men talk about their shoes, but nothing like the women talk about their shoes. And if it's fashion, it's even, you know, there's even more to talk about. But to get a man into this type of shoe. The other thing that happened that was really difficult is that I mean, I really came at this thing from a personal passion. What would I want to wear? How would I want this to be? And I said, you know, we'll make the best shoe we can. When it's done, we're going to find out how much it costs. We're going to take a normal markup, and that's going to be the price of the shoe. And so our shoes, you know, cost typically $225 to $250, but we have, you know, Gore-Tex Sherling line shoes that can, you know, be $300 or up. And when I took these things to the shoe stores, what the reaction was really remarkable. I would go to see maybe a guy that I knew from, you know, 25 years ago, and they go, wow, Bruce, this is fantastic. God, they make sense. And these shoes are made in Portugal. They're made in Europe. They're made with, you know, Italian leathers and European materials and Italian soles and so forth. And he said, this is fantastic. You can't make a shoe any better than this. This is fantastic. He said, I just don't have a customer for a $230 shoe. But can you get me a pair? And the interesting thing really was that the consumers understood the shoes better than the retailers. The retailers are running scared. You know, they were used to selling $150 men's shoes, $180 men's shoes, $120. The consumers walked in and they understood, because really what we're selling is more like if this was a Ferragamo or a Gucci or something, it would be a $400 or $500 shoe.
Right, right.
So we didn't go out with a marketing campaign that said, oh, we're going to give you a $400 shoe for $250. But in fact, you can't make a shoe any better than this. You can't use better materials. You can't get finer details.
At that price.
At any price. You can't make a better. You can't make it. You can make it by hand and make it take forever and, you know, not use a stitching machine. Just put every stitch in by hand. But you won't get a better shoe. It won't feel any better or look any better than that. So, you know, we buy the most expensive leathers, the most expensive linings. There's no corners that are cut. But what I've really found is that the consumers understand these kind of things better than
a
lot of retailers.
Point.
And I think back to the Apple computer and how, you know, people say, oh, so they're fantastic computers, but for $1,500, I can buy a Dell or a Compaq for $600
or
$500 or an IBM. Why would I want to spend, you know, $1,200? Try to get a Macintosh computer away from somebody who has a Mac. You know, they're just looking forward to their next one. So this is what happened with the shoes, is that we went outside of the normal boundaries of what people thought they would pay for a shoe. But letter after letter after letter said, I never spent so much on a pair of shoes, and now I can't wear any other shoe.
That's such a great takeaway right there, that you know, sometimes the retailers themselves maybe they're too close to the situation to even spot the opportunity.
Yeah.
But if they give it a shot and they try it, like, hey, you know, wow, I didn't realize there's opportunity
this
here.
This is what, and this happens over and over and over again. I had one funny story was that we were running a trunk show in a store. My salesman, a trunk show is where you put all your different models out.
Yep.
And it was a trunk show for men's shoes in a women's store. And the woman was over talking to my salesman she said, "What these shoes all about?" And he was telling her, and she said, "Oh, my husband never buys. You know, he would never buy $250 shoes." And they're talking away, and suddenly they look over, and her husband is checking out with two pair. You know, and she's looking at him like, "What are you?" And so, half of the people that call us are women buying shoes for men.
That's an amazing statistic. Half the people are the women who purchase
on the telephone. On the telephone, half of the women, half of the people. We get 2,000 phone calls a week. And I know you wanted to talk about customer support. So
yes. So we're actually going to take a commercial break. But when we come back, we're going to talk about the fact, I mean, you won the Gold Stevie Award. That's not an easy accomplishment. We love talking about customer service here. One of our famous guests was Shep Hyken. So we certainly want to get to that. We're going to take a short commercial break. Stay tuned.
Hey, Joe, give me a minute. I'm going to run the numbers and circle back next week. Post it on Facebook, LinkedIn. Just get it up there.
You're great at what you do, and you're busier than ever. We get that. Imagine if you could devote every minute of your day to running your business and taking it to the next level. Enter Bottom Line Marketing Group. Bottom Line Marketing Group focuses on making your company look great, so you can focus on growing your business. To see some award-winning projects produced by Bottom Line Marketing Group, visit www.bottomlinemg.com. That's www.bottomlinemg.com. Or call CEO Yitzhak Saflis on his direct line for a free consultation at 718-412-3505. That's 718-412-3505. Bottom Line Marketing Group. Marketing solutions to grow your bottom line.
Okay, so you're considering a comprehensive medical exam, but you haven't decided where. At Elytra Health in New York City, we know you have a tight schedule and that you only want the best. We also know you have choices to consider. Well, consider that you could have a world-class executive longevity exam at Elytra's state-of-the-art Manhattan Center for Life and Longevity, right in downtown New York City. Think about the fact that the experts at Elytra Health are a hand-selected staff with more than 30 years of experience in executive exams and concierge medicine, and that top doctors in the area refer their patients to Elytra. Something else to weigh is that cardiac imaging, cancer screening, labs, and all other testing is completed in a single five-hour visit with white-glove service. Plus, you'll receive the results, advice, and follow-up coordination before you leave. Finally, consider how easy it is to get peace of mind from an Elytra exam now by visiting ElytraHealth.com. That's E-L-I-T-R-A Health.com. Elytra Health. Well, above all.
Missed an episode of Mind Your Business? We've got you covered. Check out our YouTube channel, Mind Your Business with Yitzhak Saflis, to hear interviews with business executives and thought leaders whenever and wherever you want. That's Mind Your Business with Yitzhak Saflis.
And we're back. Mind Your Business, right here on 77 WABC. Week in and week out, we've been here since mid-2015. Pretty exciting. We're going to be in our fifth calendar year come 2019. It's pretty exciting. And with the ratings, and a special thank you to the wonderful listeners and to the great feedback I receive all the time. My guest this evening is none other than the founder and CEO of Samuel Hubbard Shoes, Bruce Katz. Bruce, thank you so much for joining me in studio here on Mind Your Business.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, we got to talk about the Gold Stevie Award. Winning an award for customer service is a very big feat. Customer service is at the top of mind for any company that wants to scale. So you won it 2 years in a row. How'd you pull that off?
When we were in the middle of our success with Rockport, my father was a very modest man, and I watched him once when people would come into because after having basically closed a shoe factory after 30 years of a family business, you have to be able to hold your head up. Yeah. People would come in and they would say to him, "Wow, Saul, you're doing Saul Katz was my father, and said, Rockport is doing so well," and instead of saying, "Yeah, we're really killing it," or something, he would make a very modest statement, and he would say, "Yes, we're making a lot of friends with our shoes." And that idea always stuck in my mind. And actually, before my father died, when he was 95 years old, I told him I might go back and start a company called Hubbard and make the factory into a brand that it never was, because had it been a brand, it would probably not have gone out of business as a factory.
And what did he
say? So, I put a big smile. I didn't know whether he was going to say, "Oh, my God, don't go back and do that," or, he's going to put a smile on his face.
Special,
and I said, there's
special.
Something, of being the third generation, maybe we just have to set the record straight here. Anyway, when I started this company, I decided that we were going to have to basically build it from the ground up. And I decided we're going to make friends one pair at a time. And everybody who came to the company, I said, look, this every customer is we've got to make that relationship, and we've got to make it count. So on a basic level, I said, one of the things I hate is, you know, I thought we're going to probably get some phone calls. And so how are we going to handle those?
Right.
And we later, we did some mail order catalogs, and like everybody in the company was on the phone. I mean, the phone's ringing off the hook in every which way. And I said, we are going to answer every single phone call with a person. We will never, ever have a robot that goes, press one for this, two for this, three for that. Sorry, we're having an unexpected amount of calls. Blah, 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 blah. Everybody hates that. No, nobody finds it more convenient to press one for this, two for that, three for that. I don't understand for the life of me why, like, you know, when you call Hewlett-Packard, somebody doesn't say, good morning, Hewlett-Packard. I have a problem with my printer. Let me put you over to the printer division. Good morning, Hewlett-Packard Printers. How can I help you? How many people does that take? They spend tens of millions of dollars on marketing, and then they alienate their customers with this horrible treatment. And I said, we are never going to do it. And when the phones overflow, we pay $5 a phone call to have it go to an answering service that still answers the phone and said, I will take a message and we will call you back. And so we get, you know, we get about 2,000 phone calls a week on average. We have 8 people answering the phone. And it's very interesting because I have a wonderful guy, Chris, who runs it. And we had a meeting one day with some of his people. He's trained all these people. And they said, boy, we love working at Hubbard Shoe. This is the best job we've ever had, you know. And I said, well, I know we have a little, you know, pasta on Fridays. And, you know, we try to have a family orientation. But what is it you love about working here?
Right.
And they said, we love it because we never have to say no to a customer.
Wow. You empower them. You give them...
We say yes. And my point of view on this thing is, you know what? First of all, I trust people. If 0.5% of the people, you know, try to do something that they shouldn't do, I don't care.
And you're not going to penalize the other
99%.
I'm
not going to penalize everybody
because
for that. You know, you know what it feels like when you stay in a nice hotel and they want to double-check your room to make sure you didn't eat a pack of potato chips and you're spending $400 a night for a room? I mean, what...
Right.
What are they doing?
Right.
What are they thinking?
Right. Because of those few that spoil it for the rest.
Yeah.
You can't penalize everyone.
And it doesn't even matter
right.
if you eat the potato chips, really. Does it really matter? And so, you know, we basically say yes. And if a guy said, you know, I wore them, I thought I was going to get, you know, more time on the sole. First of all, we have a resoling program. We resole the shoes. But, you know, sometimes we have to replace the shoe for somebody, or we swap the shoe, or... Whatever it takes, we want the people to be happy. We want them to feel like this is a hospitable place.
Right.
And if people want to talk for 20 minutes about their bunion and their experience with their shoes for their whole life, so be it. That nobody's trying to hurry anybody off the phone. So if I could just say one thing about how to give great customer support is treat people the way you would like to be treated in every instance. You do not want to wait on 17 minutes on hold. You don't, you know, you have to have enough people to answer the phone, and you have to treat them courteously. I want to share one story with you that happened because it was funny. This was in the early days. We were still probably maybe a, you know, $2 million business or something.
Okay.
And the head of merchandising, the phones, we got too many phone calls. So she grabbed the phone.
Okay.
And a woman answers, and she said, hello, is this Samuel Hubbard? Yes, yes. Oh, great. I understand that you have a blue suede shoes. Do you make a blue suede shoe? Yes, we do. Oh, well, my son is having his birthday tomorrow. He's 60, and he's a big fan of Elvis Presley. And somebody told me that you have blue suede shoes, and I thought it would be so perfect if I could get him a blue suede shoe. And she said, we have that. Yeah. Well, where are you located? I mean, I don't even know if she knew we were in California. And we said, well, we're in Mill Valley.
Right.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm over in Belvedere, which is a very wealthy sort of island just near Mill Valley. She said, my driver is off today.
Tomorrow.
Do you think it would be possible to bring the shoes over to my house? And without missing a beat, in 1 second, Bridget said, oh, that's perfectly fine. We'll be happy to have the shoes delivered for you. Just let me know what size and where you live. And we spent $75 to deliver these shoes. We never charged her a penny. And we delivered shipping, these shoes for her. Now, why did we do that? I mean, on a purely commercial basis, we took all of the gross margin and spent it on a delivery guy. Now, I can't tell you why exactly, but it just seems like the right thing to do. And I think you have to do those kinds of things. You have to have sort of spontaneous acts of generosity. And I think that people too often forget the importance of generosity and compassion and empathy. And these are the most fundamental parts of the experience.
There's so much to cover, and I know we have only approximately 10, 15 minutes left. We touched on this earlier, but I want to come back to it because of how important it is. You have a strong retail presence in throughout these 600-plus shoe stores nationwide. And, of course, you have a great channel through SamuelHubbard.com. Again, that's the site to visit where you could purchase your own pair, SamuelHubbard.com. Why is it so important to maintain a presence in both spaces?
That's a $64,000 question.
Yeah.
I mean, in my experience with Rockport, I mean, independent retailers were the backbone. I mean, some people start in the shoe business, they just want to go and sell the biggest chain stores and everything else. Started off selling shoes out of the back of my pickup truck. And for me, it's a personal thing that the independent retailer, you know, was always a champion of good product. And I've tried to, you know, maintain that part of the business. But it's, you know, we do as much as we can to support them with training and with in-store displays. And we put shoes on the feet of the people who work there
So that they drink the Kool-Aid. That's a good point. So that they really.
But I mean, they are a dying breed. I mean, I hate to say it. There are some great shoe retailers in America who will, you know, probably have another generation coming along. Right. But I'm not sure that people, when they get out of college, go, "Gee, you know, when I get out of school, I really want to try to open a shoe store." You know, they want to go open some .com something or other. And those kinds of people are slowly going away, unfortunately, because I think, you know, there's a real experience to going in and having someone who understands your feet, your size, and what's the right kind of shoe for you for what you need. So I think it's an important part of the puzzle.
And what I will point out is, I know when I purchased my Hubbards, when I went online, your site has such a fantastic amount of information, how the shoe is made, and so it was really a fantastic experience. Like you said, it took a long time to build, and I'm sure you make pivots along the way, but like the information that you have on that site is just like unreal.
Well, when I started, I had this crazy idea that the way I was going to launch the company was I was going to build a shoe store, and I was going to put sort of GoPro cameras on people's chest, and when you landed at the website, you were going to see, you know, a Skype session that would drop you into the store, and somebody would say, "I can't see you, that's okay, but if you'd like to talk to me, I'm happy to help you. And if you'd like to see a shoe, just tell me which one you'd like to see." And then you would direct them to go around and say, I want to see this over on the left wall, and they would show it to you and tell you about the shoe. And then I thought, well, how would I scale this? And I said, well, maybe I'll just hire students who are traveling around the world, and they can do Skype from the beach or wherever they are in a cafe in Nepal. And we'll just have a server that will automatically load, you know, send these people out to these sessions, and they'll all make, you know, $10 a pair if they can, you know, sell a pair of shoes, right? So I've always wanted to have, I still don't think I built the website that I would like to build, because
it's
think
fantastic.
Eventually you'd
it's
like
fantastic.
To actually have an experience of actually communicating with someone, but we do the best we can with the printed page on the web.
Another question is, you've been scaling the business, I mean, certainly from your initial purchase of 1,500 pairs.
15,000 pairs.
15,000, I'm sorry, 15,000 pairs. Right?
It's a lot
really
more worrisome when there's 1,500. I could probably give them to my friends.
So you had talked about, scaling a business. I mean, that's really my question, not what we talked about, but what are your tips on scaling a business that was, you know, built and it's solid and you're getting great customer reviews, et cetera, but then you want to take it to the next level? What are your tips for a business that wants to scale?
This is something we could spend an hour on, but I was always a bootstrap entrepreneur, because when I started when my father and I started Rockport at the end of the Hubbard Shoe Factory closing, the total family paid in capital was $15,000. That's all we had left. I had five, my brother had five, and my mother had $5,000 under the mattress or something. And that was, so we had to make money from day one. That has not been possible for me in this business. This has taken substantial investment to get to where we are today. I still believe, because it's kind of almost, you know, a business religious belief for me, that you can do it, you know, by being profitable from the beginning. And I think a lot of companies, you know, that go out and raise a lot of money actually never figure out, you know, how to become profitable, because they build a culture around, oh, we're just going to gain scale, and it's all about scale, and it doesn't matter, you know, we're going to lose $10 million this year and $20 million next year, and then, you know, we're going to make $100 million when we sell it, or when we, I don't know what. I mean, I think you'd have to try to build something that scales by being practical and profitable as soon as you possibly can. And if you build it that way, it may be a little smaller coming out of the ground. It may look like a seedling that's barely going anywhere. But if you build it on that, if you build that culture, then you will build a company that will always stay profitable and will be very, very healthy. And the other can be really, you know, can go the other way.
Great advice. Print versus digital in the marketing world. I know we touched on that earlier. You run an aggressive campaign in the Times, in the Wall Street Journal. Let's come back to that for a minute. You know, like you said, some of your buddies said, "Well, print is dead." You know,
right? Why are you cutting down all these trees? Yeah. I mean, we're doing you know, a lot of mail order catalogs. You know, 70 page mail order catalogs.
Really, you have a 70 page?
Yeah, mail. I mean, this year 2.5 million. You know, we did 2.5 million catalogs. Part of that for me, the print, is that now I have people who have just yesterday debated me very seriously. I felt like to create an image for a company, to create some feeling about what it's about and what it's about, you know, what it means to wear a pair of these, right, beyond just that it's a good product and that people like wearing it, you know, what does it stand for? And I've always asked myself, how would you build Ralph Lauren all over again without ever using print, with a billboard or a fashion show or a mansion on Madison Avenue? How would you create that sort of a charisma and image for something? And so, you know, I'm very visual, and you can build all kinds of images on the web, but it's so visual. It's just so kind of ethereal. It just kind of there, goes away. It doesn't, you know,
doesn't have the credibility.
When you arrive in Milan and you see a billboard all the way up the side of a building for Armani, you go, wow. You know, it's just, and you, and some, you know, fantastic scene or some fantastic photograph or something. So I think there's a lot to be said for the visual printed page. You know, it is absolutely a dying industry in terms of the printed publications. I mean, the newspapers are struggling, the magazines they're all struggling against digital media. But I think there's really a place for it in the mix. I mean, going forward, I think we will use a lot more social media types of activities, because now we have, you know, we're heading for a couple hundred thousand people who are wearing the shoes. And at that point, you know, then you have something to talk about. And a friend of mine told me about those, and this, you know, and then you can really, now that I visited a company yesterday that did it entirely in digital, and has a very, you know, and ramped up tens of thousands of users completely from a digital conversation. And it seems very ironic to me that, having spent 14 years pioneering online communities,
that's right,
I would be saying that to you. But in a way, when I came back, I kind of fell back into what I knew.
But you know what I have to point out is that every smart entrepreneur and business understands that you're going to reach out to the people and the channels that you'll connect with them. I mean, I have here in my office a drawer full of mailings that have come from Google and other companies. I mean, even to receive mail from Google, doesn't that sound crazy?
Yeah, right.
I don't believe you.
So,
but the answer is, Google isn't stupid. They understand that they have to reach the people and through various different channels. Of course, I get emails from them, and there is online ways that they're reaching out, but they're also using any form of marketing that they know will work. So we're actually very close to out of time, but before we go, my final question would be, you have a life of experience in so many different areas, and of course within the shoe retail industry. Are there any final takeaways that you could give to aspiring business people, people that want to go to the next level in their career? What advice would you give, Bruce?
Well, I have an answer I want to give you, and I have to give credit to these people. I visited a wonderful company in Portsmouth, New Hampshire called Rust and Salt.
Okay.
And I felt like I had 3 hours at a table with six business shrinks yesterday, and they all helped me enormously. And I have to thank them for the time that they spent, because I really came away with a focus, and because they could see it and I couldn't see it. And what they said was, you know what you're doing? You are following your passion. It's not that you needed another business, because you didn't need another business. And it's not like you're making shoes because everybody, there's no shoes in the world. You started with a shoe you wanted to make for yourself, and you're following that passion. And that's what you should continue to focus on as you go forward, is make sure that what you're doing is right in the sweet spot of what you're passionate about. And if you stay in that spot, then that will come across, and you will do the right thing, and you will find your way to the place that you're supposed to be in the world of business.
Bruce, I can't thank you enough for joining me here on Mind Your Business.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
What a great show. In case you're just tuning in now, I don't know where you were, but good news, by Tuesday morning, this entire episode will be up on the permanent channel for this show, mybradio.com, mybradio.com. And, of course, you could listen through the various different channels that you prefer. This will turn into a YouTube video episode. That probably won't be up by Tuesday, but within the coming days. And, of course, if you are on the email list, you will receive it. You could receive the emails. Just go to subscribe on mybradio.com, mybradio.com. Well, this wraps up another great edition of Mind Your Business. Tune in again next Sunday night at 10 p.m. for another great edition of Mind Your Business right here on 77 WABC.
77 WABC Radio presents Mind Your Business, hosted by founder and president of Bottom Line Marketing Group, Yitzhak Safliff. Mind Your Business focuses on business and marketing strategies for success. Tune in every Sunday night for this intriguing weekly radio show that's chock full of business insights and marketing strategies that will help you get ahead of the game. Host Yitzhak Safliff has been producing pioneering and creative marketing work for over two decades. He leads a team of marketing experts who help their clients build their brands and grow their businesses. Now, he and his guests offer their business and marketing expertise to you every Sunday night on Mind Your Business.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.